Recently, I had someone reach out to me for some advice. This person, let's call them Rivka, identifies as a member of both the Jewish and queer communities and wanted my input on how to deal with some conflicting feelings she was experiencing around the realm of politics. Now, this was the day after President-elect Trump posted his threat that there would be all hell to pay if Hamas did not release the hostages before his inauguration. And Rivka's Jewish friends were taking to social media to celebrate this strong, no-nonsense language. Personally, I'm more of an action-speak-louder-than-words kind of guy, and the truly meaningful test still waits ahead. But I can certainly understand that after not having someone of authority speak this directly and aggressively towards Hamas in quite a while, just posting these words was, in many ways, an action in itself and something to be celebrated. So, Rivka. On the one hand, she saw her Jewish friends admiring Trump in this moment. And on the other hand, as a queer-identifying person, she remained extremely worried about how his administration might seek to roll back LGBTQ+ rights, which is unfortunately a valid concern, and in certain respects is already in motion. Totally reasonable that someone like Rivka might be torn in this moment. And so she wanted to know, what do we do with these conflicting ideas? Do we celebrate Trump standing up for Jews? Or do we oppose him for the threat he represents to the queer community and others? What I told her was that the answer, of course, was both. Which may sound obvious and so simplistic as to almost sound condescending, but it's actually not the default way contemporary society has been teaching us to reconcile discordant notions. We live in an aggressively polarized country in an aggressively polarized world. Over the past several decades, we have been slowly pushed into this more tribalistic model by a number of factors. Our politicians who demonize their opponents, our news media who denigrate those who don't agree with their point of view, our social media that creates echo chambers and promotes incendiary rhetoric, elements of modern social justice movements that have framed our society as an oversimplified binary of oppressors versus the oppressed. And of course, all these ideas are often reinforced in our schools and universities. The notion that polarization is just the way the world is so ubiquitous, it may as well be in the water. By design, our brains already love to categorize and put things in neat little boxes. Our minds absorb so much data every single second, mental shortcuts are a necessity for our brains to be able to handle all the vital tasks required of them. So when you add this innate process to the culture's constant whisper of choose a side, the impulse for many is to do just that. Sort everything into one of two boxes. It's either or, black or white, good or bad. Life and its intricacies are far more complex than a simple binary can explain. We know this, and yet we seem to have forgotten how capable we are of processing that complexity without having to pick a team or smush everything into a box that doesn't quite fit. The notion that we must choose sides is a false paradigm. We don't actually have to do that, no matter what our peers on social media or in real life may think. And in fact, we shouldn't do that if we want to have a more communicative, cooperative, and stable society. There is no shame or controversy in acknowledging two competing truths. Any negative response to an accurate grasp of reality is due to the small-mindedness of the observer, not any shortcoming in the person who's actually getting things right. So bringing it back to Rivka, there is nothing wrong with saying, I applaud Trump standing up against terrorists, and I worry about his agenda towards the queer community. I mean, we could do this all day on any subject, right? You love your kids the most, and they annoy you the most. Non-gender conforming people deserve dignity in the workplace, and changing all shared restrooms to gender neutral can be extremely uncomfortable to gendered men and women who have no desire to poop next to someone of the opposite sex, which is something that happened to me in the middle of a show I was working on. Republican attitudes towards climate change are catastrophically self-centered, and we can't afford to just abandon fossil fuels without endangering our economy and stability. Israel is one of the most amazing, democratic, and innovative places in the world, and its prime minister is an untrustworthy, power-hungry stain on liberal values. Trans people deserve respect and dignity, and student athletes deserve respect and consideration when they're forced into an uncomfortable or unfair competition with someone whose biology is objectively different than their own. Life is hard, and life is beautiful. Now, perhaps you may disagree with me on one or more of the specific points I addressed, and that's totally fine. But the simple fact that there are competing, equally valid truths to each situation is undebatable. Anyone who would take these statements and label one side as evil or anti or even biased is being disingenuously defensive because they are so invested in their own position, they struggle to even allow a counterpoint to be introduced to the conversation. But that doesn't make it any less true or valid. It just makes that person unreasonable. Ask yourself, what's more reasonable? Acknowledging the complexity of life's challenges or asserting that everything has only a single right answer and it's yours? Holding two truths simultaneously, like much of what I discuss on this show, is just another muscle you have to exercise. The more you do it, the easier it gets. Because it's actually a much more natural and logical way of approaching the world than binary tunnel vision. In closing, I will leave you with a final double truth. You enjoyed this monologue, and you're ready for it to be over now. Totally with you. This is the 14th episode of Being Jewish with me, Jonah Platt. My guest today is a quickly rising star of the New York theater scene. His work as a director, however, is about much more than just entertainment. Through his activism and advocacy, he has used art as a vehicle to foster dialogue, provide education, and bridge gaps between communities in today's fragmented world. He's involved with several arts advocacy organizations, including one for which I am a board member. He's also the youngest Black director to ever have a show on Broadway, which maybe he's getting sick of hearing about. I don't know. I'll ask him. Please welcome the very talented and very humble Jalen Livingston.
Hey, what's up?
You know, just doing a little interview
just
show. How are you doing?
A little podcast. It's all good. Yeah, I'm good. I'm so grateful to be here.
Thanks Thank for you for being here. I'm grateful to have you. So I want to start with the obvious. What is this not Jewish theater maker doing on a show called Being Jewish? Because of your work as artistic director of an organization called the Inheritance Theater Project, which I'm a board member, I wanted to bring you on so we could explore that work, and that can be our entree into the rest of the conversation. So first, why don't you tell us what Inheritance Theater Project is and what it's all about?
Sure. So the Inheritance Theater Project is a national nonprofit founded by John Adam Ross, who is our executive director.
Shout out to Jar.
Very close collaborator, colleague, and friend. And I started with the organization maybe around 2017, just as an associate artist. Last year became the artistic director. And what the Inheritance Theater Project does is we go around to different communities in the country and we ask a set of questions, one of being, what is the history of this place? What are the stories of the people who live in the place today? And then what does it mean to bring an inherited text to this community as a kind of orienting, foundational conversation starter?
What do you mean when you say inherited text?
So we think of inherited text as these kind of foundational stories or narratives that multiple generations have had some kind of relationship to. And so a great example within our work of an inherited text or an inherited narrative or story would be like the story of Exodus.
Right.
It's cross-generational, obviously, but also cross-denominational. Christians know the story. Jewish people know the story. People who watch cartoons know the story, right? Yeah. And so this story of a people being freed from bondage and making a kind of voyage to a promised land is a narrative that has been inherited. Mm-hmm. And what do we do with those inherited narratives? Why are they still around today? How do we wrestle with them? And how do they actually help reflect and refract back to us the narratives that are emerging in our society today?
That was an awesome recap. I feel like that was a really good—
Hopefully John would be proud.
Yeah, it's tricky to to give the elevator pitch because it's so unique and it's so involved. It's not like a, here's a thing we do in a week. It's a 9-month really involved process, which I got to actually experience. We'll get into that a little bit later. I want to talk more about that. Mm-hmm. It isn't a Jewish organization, but it has a very Jewish soul to it. It was founded by Jews. It's supported a lot by Jews. Very Jewish ethos of mm-hmm. social justice and tikkun olam and sacredness of text. Do you feel that? Like, do you feel a connection to what Judaism is about through the work?
I totally do. I feel like sometimes, and I identify as a Christian, but I feel like sometimes I want to lean into the Judaism of the organization, sometimes even more than the Jews involved, because I think sometimes as an outsider, you just have a certain objective view of the technology, you know, where I didn't grow up doing Seder.
Right.
I didn't grow up really knowing any Jewish people.
Right. You're from Shreveport?
I'm from Shreveport, Louisiana. I knew one Jewish boy in elementary school named Ron DeBenedetti. I don't know where he is now.
Shout out to Ron.
Shout out to Ron. And he would eat a bagel every lunch and he would put cheese on the bagel.
Eating a bagel every day. We can do
but
better
then
than
he
that.
Would put Cheetos on the bagel. And okay, I was so like, that's so dope. Ron with the Cheetos and the And I remember one time I tried it and I was like, nah, that's really just for Ron. But that's
I don't know if that sounds that dope to me.
It wasn't great. I really knew nothing about Judaism outside of what like maybe questionable education might have told me,
right?
Which then left me with lots of like big broad questions I think a lot of people have who don't grow up around Jewish people. And so I didn't really like interface intimately with Jewish people at all until a little bit in college, but I went to college in Los Angeles and I lived in Hollywood, and so there was more there, but really wasn't until I moved to New York and was actually like collaborating professionally that I was able to have intimate relationships with Jewish people, which is to say, see the ways in which their cultural technology and religious technology could be used to create spaces that I was interested in. So there's always going to be a kind of inherent Jewishness to the Inheritance Theater Project. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a gift. And I think that just like I bring everything that I love about my cultural background and also religious background to my work without it having to be overtly labeled anywhere. Right. You know, it just is what it is. If it's a real culture, it finds its way into the room.
I want to dial in on your use of the word technology. You've said that word a lot. How do you define technology? Because you're using it in places that I haven't typically heard it used.
Yeah. I mean, I think of technology as something that helps you achieve something you couldn't do by yourself. Mm. And, you know, arts is a kind of technology.
Right.
And I also use the word technology because it's active. You know, technology is powered by the human, but it's an assist, you know. And so it still takes you coming to the table and using this thing and then creating a different reality that you would have had without it. And so when I think of, you know, one of my I always make John laugh because when I learn a new Jewish word, I'm like, I've learned this word now and this will now be my hyperfixation for a while now. But me and Rebecca Shorsh, who is our dramaturgical scholar in residency for the Inheritance Theater Project, work very close to create workshops and methodologies within our spaces. And we are in Havruta together. And like learning about Havruta, it's like that's my jam. Like long-term study with another over time. You know, like it's like I love that stuff.
Well, define it for us, because not all my audience is gonna know what Havruta means.
And I'm gonna probably like not give
Well, give us your
accurate,
understanding.
But my
of
understanding
it.
Of it is like rigorous long-term wrestling with another person over a long period of time.
Wrestling and over what?
Wrestling over an idea, wrestling over text.
Were those conversations between you and Rebecca about devising the methodology, or you're saying you two were debating the text yourselves?
It was a little bit of both. I mean, in trying to create a space where people could wrestle with text, we're also wrestling with the text and trying to negotiate it and figure it out. And what I kind of, what emerged out of that work was maybe an answer to our divided times isn't necessarily a mass quantity of people agreeing to anything at once, but maybe more intimate, small, intense and rigorous long-term relationships being built, and then tasking those relationships with creating something for multiple people or a large group of people to experience. I'm a Southern Black queer male Christian. Rebecca is a Jewish academic in her 60s, not from the South. It felt like the perfect structure to hold people who have who come from different backgrounds.
Yeah.
And so that's a long way of saying, like, that's how I see part of the Jewish technology being used to impact the work that
I do. Pretty ancient technology.
Very ancient technology.
So specifically about these salons that you did over the past year, I don't know if this was the sole text or one of the texts, but it was there was a James Baldwin text you were working with. Said the Negro is anti-Semitic because the Negro is anti-white.
Mm-hmm.
How did that go, discussing that? I mean, that's
how did that go?
An interesting, certainly ripe for discussion.
Yeah, well, we were trying to find a text that people could wrestle with that didn't feel like it was necessarily being didactic about the times we're in terms of like telling you what to think about anything, but also kind of diving you into a rich tradition of conversation. And what I had been told was that, you know, Black people and Jewish people had a certain kind of solidarity with each other in the 60s. And over time, that solidarity had started to fracture for however many reasons, you know, that could happen. There's multiple reasons. And in finding that text, what I realized is it was published in 1968, which is right in the center of when this narrative was being kind of like passed down that like this was the good times and now we're living in this bad time. And I found that complicated because there was a lot of Jewish and Black solidarity in the 60s. And also there were real complications about what does it mean for us to hold these identities and live in the empire that is America? What does that do to us? What does that do to our relationships? And so we felt like that could be a really ripe text to bring Jewish storytellers and Black storytellers together around. And after our first salon, what we were really kind of rocked by was the realization that the chances that James Baldwin titled that text himself, very slim. Most likely he was commissioned and then a white power base said, this is what this article is called.
Interesting.
And so that changes the relationship to like the overt provocativeness of the title, which is not found anywhere in the text itself.
The quote I read is the title of the piece?
It's the title of the piece. Not titled by James Baldwin.
Interesting. And not appearing itself within the piece.
And not appearing itself within the piece. And so there's already this outside kind of thing trying to frame how you enter. And so it was interesting to be like, oh, well, then we need to figure out a different way to enter the text. And a lot of the Black storytellers in the room were like, either I've read this before and I've heard this before, and I really don't want to be in a room trying to explain something that James Baldwin was asked to explain 50 odd years ago. It feels like his legacy to us is not to continue to labor in this way. And so that was like my ego being like, oh shit, did I bring the wrong text in? Oh no, what does this mean? And then the Jewish people in the room, particularly what I would consider white Jewish people in the room, because I think it's important to say in this particular salon, there were no Black Jews. And that has changed as we've gone along. But there was a lot of silence. And I was just like, this is not my experience of wrestling with Jewish people. My experience is like deep conversation and challenging and pull and tug and learning and capacity building, and that felt central to the cultural identity.
Right.
And there was something about that framing of that text, that conversation, what it meant to be in a room with other Black people, that actually turned the room white as opposed to Jewish. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is I see a kind of like silence to difficult conversation or a kind of overt performance of politeness mm-hmm. as a non-Jewish characteristic. Mm-hmm. And so what felt like it was coming up in the room were all the ways in which America shapes us as identities to be together. That if I'm in the room with these Black people, I am white, not Jewish. And if I'm in the room with these Jewish people, I'm a Black person who has an answer to an existential question. And it's up to me to build the capacity. And what, you know, me and Rebecca found this other great text by a writer named Kevin Quashie. It's from a book called The Black Aliveness, A Poetics of Being. And basically what it posits is that we read Black text with a kind of racist framework that says if this is a Black writer, it is either exposing or a trauma that we all need to look at, or it is trying to teach me something. Or if I don't understand it, I'm constantly in a state of hoping to be taught or to understand. And that actually an alternative to that is just to be in a Black world. And in a Black world, there's room for everyone. Hmm. In a Black world, my color is not just my color. Blackness is a way of being together. And that to me elevated the condition of Blackness in the way that I have seen the condition of Jewishness be elevated as a real cultural practice and a real way of being in the world differently. Hmm. And what came out of our conversations was, how can we create a space wherein Black people are expressing from a place of aliveness to Jewish people expressing from a place of aliveness, and that cultural whiteness is decentered, not forgotten about, not accounted for, but not the given, not the norm. That actually, how do we put each other in relationships with our most infinite beings and an infinite selves, as opposed to our most politically reductive selves?
I love that. I love everything you just said. So something you and I worked on together through the Inheritance Project was a project bringing together Black Jewish and Black Jewish communities in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. my hometown, mm-hmm. around the idea of a Juneteenth Seder.
Yep.
So first, you know, what and why a Juneteenth Seder?
Well, I mean, both Juneteenth as a holiday and the Seder tradition is rooted around a kind of Exodus narrative. And so they are cousins mm-hmm. in terms of their relevancy to each other. The idea of trying to understand a people trapped in empire back in that time. Mm-hmm. And what does it mean to be people who are trying to free themselves in America? Obviously, clear links.
Yeah.
And so it felt like a natural merging of cultural stories and traditions, and felt like a way in which both Jewish folk and Black folk could come together around a common theme of liberation that wasn't simple, but possible.
What was this process like? And what did you learn from this experience?
Well, we really come to these cities to really hear what the community wants to say, what's emerging.
Yeah.
But because we've done this work a while, we kind of know when certain things aren't being said in a room, what does that mean? Mm. And when certain things are said in a room, what does that mean? And so part of what we do is we build these workshops with communities, and we have a kind of prompt-based approach to generating work with them. And Rebecca was there to kind of use the tenets of the Seder ritual to like lead people through talking about themes around their own city. And so we would hold different workshops.
Which I got to participate in a couple.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And eventually those workshops go from kind of common identities to identities that start to get more mixed. And we call that going from a kind of like home base or safe space to a braver space. Mm-hmm. And then by the time we start to make art together, we're trying to create emergent space together, something we haven't seen together before. Mm. And so it was really fascinating in Los Angeles to hear from Jewish citizens who also consider themselves lifelong Los Angelinos, mm-hmm. In the stories of anti-Semitism that they experienced as people who have been in LA for a very long time, what my grandmother experienced, or, and you know, it's not always, I think, centered the ways in which maybe anti-Semitism might've found its way on the West Coast. And so it was interesting to be in multi-generational rooms, hear some of those stories, and then see younger participants be like, whoa, that happened here? That was going on here? Yeah. Whoa, what does that mean?
What were you surprised to find was maybe a commonality between these communities that you hadn't realized existed?
Just how much voyage and journey is still so central to the existential questions still driving both communities. You know, what does it mean to really have a relationship to the promised land today? What does that mean? And the ways in which both communities have never forgotten about a certain kind of promise, but also kind of have come to a really kind of radical peace with the ways in which the idea of a final destination where all your problems will be solved is not attainable.
Right. Doesn't quite exist.
Doesn't quite exist, turns out.
Did you learn anything surprising about Jews that you didn't know through that process?
Just like no one Jewish person is the same.
Right.
You know what I mean? Just in the way that no one Black person is the same.
Yeah.
And so continuing to understand the tapestry, the spectrum, I don't know if it's like surprising in that, like if I thought about it, I would probably come to that conclusion.
Right.
But to just be around it, I think was really humanizing.
That's cool. That's great. I mean, that's literally one of the main reasons this show exists, is to show off that spectrum.
Yeah.
I like the word tapestry though. I haven't used that one yet. So I'm gonna throw that one away. What is something that you feel like maybe Jews don't understand about Black folks?
I think still a lot of Jewish people, especially Jewish people who identify as culturally Jewish, ethnically Jewish, religiously Jewish, who had the traditions passed down to them, who keep the traditions, I think it's really hard for them to understand just how white they can be to a Black person.
How white they can be, meaning they're acting in a way that is white, or how white they seem to a Black person?
Sometimes both. I mean, it depends on what your relationship is, your proximity to Jewish people, obviously. To use technology in a much darker sense, the kind of technology of racism that America invented, for it to be so purely based on the color of your skin, means that without you even trying, with all the best intentions in the world, you can walk into a room and a set of conditions start to unlock that have nothing to do with anything you might have said or might have done, but that things start to move differently. And I think that that can still be a challenge, especially for people who understand how ridiculous race can be as a concept in this country, that despite that, it's still a real sociopolitical reality. And there are still things that a white passing Jewish person can do in ways of being in the world that they can be that are still really hard for a 15-year-old boy in Compton to do and be.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to frame that. How has exposure to the Jewish community and Jewish ways of thinking through Inheritance Theater Project, if at all, changed the way you think about certain things or move through the non-Jewish world?
My mind has been so validated by Jewish people.
What do you mean?
Like I said, I wasn't around Jewish people a lot growing up. And what I'm going to say is not because of something I didn't get from my family or from my culture, but in hindsight, understanding that I'm a person who's part of my day job is wrestling with ideas as a director, as an artist, that that's so central to the work of the rabbi.
Yeah, you know? 100%.
And that was always my way into my own faith, is actually really trying to wrestle with it. And not always being in a context where it was safe to wrestle with it.
I was gonna say, I mean, generally that's not that sort, it's very associated with Judaism. You question everything, not so associated with Christianity,
no.
Often the opposite.
Right, and I just knew that, like, whatever that opposite was not my relationship to God. My relationship to God was someone or some being that actually allowed me to wrestle, allowed me to ask questions that really scared me, that the questions that I was asking at 15, 16, 17, I actually only felt safe asking God, even though they were about God. And so as I started to get older and work with Jewish people, and they would kind of like sniff out the kind of like, I don't even know what you call it, the sense that I had to want to wrestle with ideas and to really never have the question be answered, they validated me as smart. And I grew up with undiagnosed ADHD.
You and me both, my man.
That's a whole nother podcast. But because of that, I told myself many different kinds of narratives about my worth and my value and what I could, what kind of space I could be in and not be in. And so it was much later when, you know, a 60-year-old Jewish woman was like, come co-teach this class at Columbia Law School with me. I was like, Columbia Law? I barely got out of high school. What do you mean? You know, that was the beginning of me understanding there are multiple ways of being smart. And just because you're not a person who is born to be on an assembly line doesn't mean that you don't have great intellectual value in some of our biggest institutions.
Amazing. You know, in regards to the response to the war going on in the Middle East, many in the theater community, in the Black community, the queer communities have used this response to express some pretty virulent anti-Jewish bigotry. I mean, is that something that you've seen?
I think I've seen a lot of ignorance.
Yeah.
What I mean by ignorance is a need to respond that is greater than your need to learn.
Yeah.
Our phones, social media, television, kind of like the mass media landscape that we live in, every force, both good and bad, filters itself there. And there's no way to turn it off. I mean, yeah, you get rid of your phone, but it's not like when you were growing up, you could watch TV and then the commercial would come on and you would go run outside and then it is back. No, you can turn on the television and have a constant stream that never stops of information and inundation. And then to feel like, well, what do I do with that? And to only feel like you have the tools to go on your phone. And I think that, like, for a certain generation, that is actually a real place. Yeah. And I think where a lot of crosstalk and miscommunication happens is cross-generationally, wherein older generations don't see social media or the platforms in which young people are trying to just express their ideas as a real place. They see, I think, the darker sides of it, the ways in which it's been used as a weapon, the way in which other forces have used social media to brainwash and inundate. But conversely, because of sometimes only seeing it from that point of view, it's really hard to see the ways in which social media is literally providing a space for people to find a vocabulary, to find a way of being and talking to each other. And so I think there's just so many confluences that end up happening in one space, and we're only given like or dislike, share or delete. But we're supposed to talk about one of the more complex issues of our time through that funnel. And so what I actually really see is, you know, I see a lot of great advocacy happening in the world. I tend to look at advocacy through kind of my own lens of someone who is anti-war just in general. I tend to believe if we're in a war, then we've already failed. That the war is not the problem. It is a solution to a problem. It's the wrong solution. And so I can, I think with that framework, I kind of can be in multiple spaces in terms of where people fall on any one issue. But what I think I see the most, especially coming out of my generation, is a desire to indict this place and not being given the space, platform, tool, ability, understanding, knowledge to do it. And so a lot gets projected onto the Israel-Gaza conflict when really what's underneath it is we don't like that this is the solution to this problem. We don't like it.
Right.
And I don't think that is the most unusual response.
No.
In the you know, many years of conflict that has happened.
I mean, who would? Who would like it, you know?
But we're contending with this brand new way of expressing it. And with this brand new way of expressing it, it's much harder for people who maybe shouldn't be talking to feel like they shouldn't be talking.
Yeah.
So there's just so much more noise.
Yeah.
What the media chooses to pick up and to not pick up goes constantly unchallenged.
Yeah.
In ways that I think are really, really detrimental.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I used to say this about millennials, and I think it's even more so about Gen Z,
yeah,
is that like millennials were taught that like all these divisions were settled. And welcome to the world wherein the divisions were settled. And then what I felt growing up is that like you slowly realize, wait, no, this stuff is still going on. And then there's a rage that comes from that. Gen Z, I think, just has no patience for it. No patience for the world that they see that doesn't make any sense. What do you mean we're fighting over X, Y, and Z? What is the value of even fighting over that? Why is this happening? All I see on my phone is that there's a dead baby in front of me.
Yeah.
And I need to respond. So what's the alternative? Where is the alternative for a 17-year-old in their bed on their phone doom scrolling a war? What is the actual alternative in terms of expression? There has to be more outlets. If not, then the same kind of algorithmic poisoning that happens through social media is happening now through the context of a real international conflict. And it only benefits those who are invested in war on either side.
You're a smart dude, Jalen.
I don't know.
Let's get into your theater work a little bit on the commercial side of things. Mm-hmm. You have had a very fruitful partnership with playwright Douglas Lyons.
Yeah.
Shout out to Doug. Famously Chicken and Biscuits, mm-hmm, and Table 17 most recently.
Yeah.
Both of these shows are what might be considered kind of old school. Mm-hmm. You know, that one is sort of a broader family comedy. Mm-hmm. One is sort of a classic rom-com.
Mm-hmm.
You guys are kind of zigging while a lot of theater is zagging. You know, it's not overtly political or psychologically challenging or agenda driven. It's got heart. It's entertaining. It's nostalgic in a way. What makes you guys want to create theater like that?
Well, one, that's just how Douglas writes. That is his natural pen. He has a kind of broad commercial sensibility about how he writes in the kind of rooms he wants to be in. And I think actually there are things that are deeply political about the theatrical event of Douglas's work and me working with him,
mm-hmm,
that aren't squarely situated on the play itself to be able to hold. So he's able to tell these kind of like heartfelt comedic stories of Black life, mm-hmm, that are accessible to all different kinds of communities without ever not being what they are, which are Black stories.
Yeah.
But what we're doing with the audience and their orientation to the story and the way we're asking them to participate in the world, I think is actually something that's quite political. We did Chicken and Biscuits in the middle of the pandemic.
Yeah.
And so to do a comedy in the middle of a pandemic, wherein the centerpiece of the comedy is a funeral,
mm-hmm,
and wherein people are coming into the space wearing masks, we're like, what does it mean to do a comedy where you may not even be able to see people laughing?
Yeah.
That there's a lot that's working on the audience subconsciously, you know, for us to be making comedy in a deeply divided time, I think actually drives home the deeply democratic nature of theater. Theater is the first democracy. So if you can get a room of people to laugh together in the first 5 minutes, you've proven something about us that the mass media doesn't want you to know.
Which is what?
Which is that we are more spiritually connected than someone might suggest,
mm-hmm,
right? And so if that is true, what else can we hold together? What else can we hold to that? We may be able to hold conflict tonight together. Mm. So in Table 17, the story of this couple that had a breakup and come together after a certain amount of time to see each other at a restaurant, we put all the audience at the restaurant. And we make you eavesdroppers on a conversation at a restaurant. But then we have these two characters actually talk to the audience like they're in a comedy club.
Right.
And because you've already laughed with these people, because you've seen certain tropes you think you are ahead of, then when it's up to you to make certain kind of judgments, you respond in a way that then the play actually reflects you back to you. And so there is a moment where the male character says something that the audience really doesn't like. He reveals something about something he has done. Mm-hmm. And some nights we get everyone going, boo, boo, boo. But we know that's going to happen. So then he has a monologue where he's explaining himself. And because we allowed you to express your judgment, you then have to express your empathy. Mm-hmm. So now we've begun to really pull at, you know, what the fabric of society is in this moment.
It's so interesting, like being able to take the sort of macro view of your body of work over the last few years and see so clearly like such a common thread mm-hmm. through such different things, through the advocacy arts mm-hmm. work, through Cats, Jellicle Ball, to Chicken and Biscuits. It's all, you sort of have your lane, like your mission and what you're trying to do, and you're doing it in all these different ways. It's cool to see.
Yeah, I think I want the shows to feel quite different, but sure. I want you as an audience to feel like there's something familiar about what I've been charged to do in this space.
Considering, you know, Chicken and Biscuits and Table 17, I felt a little bit of a similarity to how I feel and the kind of narratives I want to see in Jewish representation. Mm-hmm. Where I've seen a lot of Holocaust shows. I've seen a lot of shows about bigotry or whatever. And I'm looking for more just sort of contemporary Jewish stories of just people right. who are Jewish.
Right.
And I was just curious, is that a piece of all of the shows that you guys are doing, this
totally.
Desire to just tell these Black stories that don't have to be about slavery, they don't have to be about...
It feels like what I hear is that you want to see a Jewish world in a show.
Yeah.
That is not burdened by having to be exclusively your condition. And I think when that happens, we actually are able to hold things that are more complex than our conditions. That are more universal than mm-hmm. our conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's definitely a part of the work that I choose to do, because people who are much smarter than me have written about racism. People who are much more courageous than me have died over it. And so if I am to wear the crowns of my ancestors, part of honoring that is to not put myself in a situation where I am made to do the work that they did so eloquently. I need to be figuring out what is distinctive about the work I'm here to do, and how can I continue to push the ball forward in terms of when we say representation, what do we really mean? And, you know, I remember when Empire came out, the TV
mm-hmm.
show.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously a Black show, not explicitly about the Black condition, but also had major queer representation on that show. And I kind of mark it as a very pivotal moment in kind of middle of America, where people had a relationship to a queer person on television that could get them to understand maybe their own queer family member better, particularly mm-hmm. in the Black community. And you could go, oh yeah, they're not all like one way or the other way. Like, this is a very specific kind of character, and I'm really rooting for him.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I can see how you could desire to have something that explains, not even explains, but shows the Jewish context in a way that is driven purely by empathy and the questions we are all asking as humans.
Yeah, it's all about humanizing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Chicken and Biscuits. Mm-hmm. Are you sick of hearing that you're the youngest director, black director on Broadway? Or is it still like fun to hear every time? Because I'm sure it's like now it's like the thing that follows you around everywhere.
I'm not sick of hearing it.
Okay, good. There's a Jewish character in the show.
Yes.
The partner of the son of the main family. How did you guys, you know, work to authentically present this character? Do you guys feel like you nailed it? And what were considerations around fleshing him out?
Oh, I don't think we nailed it at all. I'm sure there have been other productions around the country that have been able to be even more culturally specific about the Jewish character in that show, primarily because I think that he's really functioning in a very particular way. He's really filling a particular kind of archetype of outsider.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think kind of some of the more comedic tropes of what it means to be a Jewish outsider in a world that is not your world shows up in that character and mm-hmm. showed up in that performance. But I definitely don't think we nailed a kind of sense of like holding both identities in a way that was even remotely what we were trying to do with the black bodies on stage.
Do you feel like that's a problem?
I think that there's definitely room for deepening and also room for critique of that representation. Because I think the truth is, you know, there was nothing identifiably Jewish about the character outside of the fact that the script says he is Jewish.
Hmm.
Because we don't go into his backstory that much. We don't go into his kind of specific cultural lens on where he is. There are a couple of references that help suggest that, but it's just like not what he's there to do.
Mm.
And so, yeah, I think if I felt like I was watching a play and the black character, I wanted his particular cultural context to come out into the piece more, yeah, I would be like, yeah, there's room for growth there. But it's hard to say in hindsight what that would have done or not done to the play. So I don't know if I like regret it outside of the fact that like if someone gave the prompt, is there more of this person's Jewish identity to be found in this role? Heck yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is it the most produced play in America?
The year it was licensed and went out.
It was the number one most produced
play,
right?
Pretty sure it was the number, either one or two, but I'm pretty sure it was the most produced.
I mean, that's amazing.
Year. Yeah, it was incredible.
Congratulations, Mazel Tov on that, first of all.
Thank you.
What do you attribute that to?
There's a need. Like, there are really, really, really talented black women all around this country who are of a certain age, who aren't given an opportunity to be fun and funny and heartfelt on stage. And so you had all these theater companies that were like, finally, I can ask this person and that person to be in one play together. Finally, that can happen. I also think it gets produced a lot because it's hilarious and it's really, really funny and it's really surprising and you really end up feeling for these characters. I think even if you walk away, even with the Jewish character, Logan, even if you walk away not feeling like you knew that much about his Jewishness outside of what it means for him to show up in his white skin in front of his black family as a gay person, you still are rooting for a character in a certain social context that is unusual for the audiences that come around Chicken and Biscuits. And so there is a kind of, like I said, work that Douglas's plays are doing ever so gently to just kind of force you through joy into relationship. And then from there, I think people are changed in really unique ways. And so I think people sense that in the play when you're doing it.
What are some stage pieces of content that you feel have moved the needle in terms of creating understanding or bridge building?
The first play that actually came to mind was The Normal Heart.
Mm. So powerful.
And it really changed me in terms of what the event of theater could do and be. And I went by myself. It was the first time my mom let me go to a play by myself without her. Mm. And I sat in between two different generations of men who were there watching the play. And so I started to understand something about generational identity, that there's something we can share even at different ages. George C. Wolfe in Between the Transitions would project the names of people who had died from AIDS.
That's right.
And there would be times in the audience where you would hear someone gasp in seeing someone's name that they knew. Mm. And so I started to understand that the power of theater really is about what floods out from the proscenium and not just what you get projecting onto the proscenium mm-hmm. or onto the fourth wall. And then after the show, everyone like quietly got up and walked out into the noisy like Times Square street. And I was like, what? This is still on me.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Big like time. I felt it. Mm-hmm. And so I knew that theater had the impact or the ability to impact you in ways you couldn't see, but you could feel. And so I stopped, you know, I think about that when my ego wants to know the way in which this play is working on a person, or is it changing the world, or what's going to happen? You know, it's like, it's things can move people in ways that your desire to see them move will never account for.
Right. As an ally to the Jewish community, what's something you want my Jewish audience to hear? And what's something you want my non-Jewish audience to take away?
That everyone is wrestling with the same questions. And if you're not wrestling, you're not alive. And so if you're so comfortable that someone else's wrestling makes you uncomfortable, then it's a mirror to how dead you are. And I think so often we can feel as if the debates that we're having, the arguments we're having, the fights that we're having is somehow shutting us down. It's because that the powers that be don't want us to know the truth about us, which is that we can withstand uncomfortable conversation. We can withstand you as a Jewish person building my capacity, me as a Black person building your capacity, and that can sometimes be really joyful and sometimes be really, really hard. Mm-hmm. But that if you're a person who is open to the ways in which we are all connected, then you will see everything as your business. And whether or not you understand a thing or agree with a thing has nothing to do with your responsibility as an alive human to be paying attention. And I think that it is not our political affiliations that divide us the most. We are divided among people who choose to be alive and people who do not.
I like that distinction. Was that message for the Jews or the non-Jews?
Both.
Okay, I want to finish off with something a little more lighthearted. We'll do a little lightning round. Have you ever been to Shabbat?
Yes.
What was the first Shabbat you ever went to?
John Adam Ross.
Oh, makes sense.
Yeah.
What's your go-to bagel order?
I think it's probably a crime, my go-to bagel order.
Let's hear it.
It's a blueberry bagel.
There's nothing wrong with the blueberry. It's unusual to be a favorite.
Really
perhaps.
Blueberry raisin.
I didn't know.
It's a thing.
That's pretty specific.
It's a thing. I like it.
With what on it?
I'll do just a regular cream cheese
cream
moment.
Cheese. I mean, cream cheese and blueberries.
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
a natural
yeah,
fit.
Yeah. But you know, I'll also mess with everything bagel.
Yeah.
Very good.
Okay. Have you ever celebrated other than Shabbat a Jewish holiday?
No, not celebrated.
All right, we got to get you an invite
yeah.
somewhere in the next
Which
year.
Which one though? Which there's so many. You
there
see.
Are so many, so you have a lot of
so
options.
Like, it's like,
someone's
got to
get you over for Hanukkah. That's coming up.
Right. I've never been over for Hanukkah.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. You got to be yeah. over for Hanukkah is a good one. Purim. Have you heard of Purim?
Mm-mm.
Purim, you basically wear costumes and get drunk. It's like a big party.
Oh,
and there's like
great.
Just literally people have parties and go wild. It's like wild night for the Jews. That's a good one. You should get, someone should invite you to a Seder. I mean, clearly.
Well, I have been to multiple Seders.
Oh, you have?
I did not count that as holiday, unfortunately.
Oh, that
I know that is the holiday, but I was thinking about how many holidays
yeah.
that Jewish people have
yeah.
that I have no understanding.
All right.
Relationship
I'm gonna, if I'm celebrating one in New York, you'll get a call.
Great.
And to end on a high, what's the best advice you've ever received?
I don't even know if it's advice, but I'll tell this story. When I was contemplating going to New York, my move from Los Angeles to New York after college, I was really struggling to figure out how to make it make sense. And I had a teacher who was like, well, let's flip a coin. Heads, you move to New York. Tails, you stay in LA. I was like, okay. And so we flipped the coin. He caught it. And he was like, what did you want when the coin was in the air? And I was like, well, I wanted it to be heads so I could go to New York. And he's like, well, then this doesn't matter. And he never showed me what
I love that flip.
And I think that that's so like indicative of how I move. And so just really trusting that the jump that your intuition is asking you to take is the right jump.
Love that. Let's end on that. Jalen, thank you so much for all the insight and for the being so candid about everything. And it's really been a pleasure chatting with you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you to Jalen for sitting down with me today and for all the work you do for so many different communities. You're definitely doing your part for Tikkun Olam, repairing the world. Thanks to everyone here at Hof Studios. And of course, thanks to all of you watching or listening to this podcast right now. You know I love you. I'll see you back in LA for the next sensational episode of Being Jewish with me, Jonah Platt.
Thank you to everyone who makes Being Jewish with Jonah Platt possible. Executive producer Matthew Jones, story producer Sean Leviashvili, and editor Patrick Edwards of Rainbow Creative. Consulting producers Bethany Mandel and Ariella Novak of Shield Communications, social media manager Yuval Yosha, graphic designer Noah Bell of Bellboy Creative, my incredible research assistant Samantha Greenwald, everyone at Aura House Studios, the whole team at Jewish Broadcasting Service, composer Gabe Mann, and of course you, dear listeners, who even stuck around to listen to all these credits. Man, I love you guys.